Our next case for argument this morning is Evanson against Evanson.
Good morning. May it please the court, Josh Vinson on behalf of the plaintiff, Jeffrey Evanston and the Evanston Trusts. The primary issue in this case concerns the district court's legal determination that a deed of trust and security agreement, which I'll refer to just as the security agreement, and not by the acronym we used in the briefs for this argument, was ambiguous. And the way the district court got to that conclusion was because it believed that a settlement agreement between the parties limited their ability to create a security agreement that secured anything beyond the $1 million debt obligation that was created in the security agreement. And the court was troubled by apparently a very broad provision in the security agreement, which is often referred to as a dragnet clause or a future advances clause, that picks up additional debt obligations that may occur or arise in the future between the parties. And the district court felt that we couldn't do that, and that as a result, any monies that the trust received or recovered related to the properties that were the subject of the deed of trust and security agreement had to be applied to the judgment and to absolutely nothing else. That conclusion that the agreement was ambiguous, the security agreement was ambiguous, was a legal error. First, the settlement agreement between the parties did not limit the scope of the, it provided for a security agreement to secure the obligation created by that settlement, but it did not limit the scope in any way, shape, or form of what security agreement the parties could enter into. They were free to negotiate whatever type of security agreement they wanted. And in fact, it was really to the parties' mutual benefit to have a future advances clause. I mean, when you are effectively joined at the hip going forward after a, a litigation like this that's been resolved with a security agreement that is based primarily on 8 different tracts of land with various types of debt already on some of them, and the fact that it almost creates a lending facility, if you will, because inevitably there will be circumstances where the debtor, the judgment debtor, or the, in this case it was originally just the settlement amount, may need additional funds, whether it's to pay taxes on the property, whether it's to repair a roof, whatever it may be, in order to preserve the value of the security. It's really to both parties' benefit. So while Mike, the defendant in this case, could have...
Is it your position that all of the amounts that were credited against debts other than the original debts were future advances made after the settlement agreement?
So the ones that we focused on in the brief were, yes. Certainly the with respect to Tract 5. In Tract 5, with regard to Tract 5, in that situation, you have the trust satisfying a nearly $600,000 mortgage on the property, all to Mike's benefit. And the indebtedness provision specifically picked up that type of obligation and refers to other obligations created like this. It refers to loan participation agreements.
Yeah, I'm a little worried by your statement, the ones we focused on in the briefs.
Well, Judge,
answer to my question is either yes or no. And if it's no, I wish you'd carefully distinguish prior advances from subsequent advances.
The answer is yes. Okay.
The answer
every,
is yes.
Yes. Every debt that was at issue in the litigation below where there was a question of credit is governed by the security agreement. And because the debt obligation, which was, part of which was the $1.2 million default judgment, also included other promissory notes, the Tract 5 payoff of senior debt on that, property taxes on that, as well, those were all future advances that were contemplated by the settlement agreement, in fact, because it did, in paragraphs 11, carve out future obligations that might be created as a result of this arrangement. Those were all things that could be applied to other debts besides the $1.2 million judgment. Those were future advances. They increased the amount of debt burden that the defendant had. Now, that's different than the Texas litigation, okay? Michael's not entitled to any credit whatsoever for the settlement of that lawsuit. That lawsuit had really nothing to do with the judgment. It had nothing to do with the settlement agreement. That was a dispute between another lien holder and the trust over, I wouldn't even say it was really over their priority, because it really didn't concern that. The trust never foreclosed on its liens in that case. What they did is they had conflicting court claims against each other. This was a litigation that was spawned by Michael's, you know, misconduct. He assigned these deeds of trust to the tracts 6 through 8 to the trust, and then turned around and disclaimed that he had any authority to do it. The trust took the position that he was in cahoots with a fellow named Lee in Texas to try and hinder or delay or defraud the trust of its interest in these properties. The Lee parties turned around and claimed that the trust was in cahoots with Michael in an attempt to try and get a superior lien position with respect to liens that he held. It really had nothing to do with Mike's debt obligation in that context. This was just a lawsuit that, you know, Mike's conduct got the trust into. And so as a result, the trust incurred nearly a little more than $700,000 in attorney's fees in that case. They settled the case for $620,000. That money went to cover attorney's fees. There was absolutely nothing about the recovery in that instance that was attributable to Michael. He had, if you look at the Lee party's complaint in that case, at docket 70-14, you'll see that they alleged that he had given no consideration for his interests in the LLCs that were at issue in that case. He contributed no money to the settlement whatsoever. So from a Rule 60B standpoint, you know, none of those payments or settlement monies that the trust recovered were attributable to Michael at all. So he gets no credit on the track 6 through 8 settlement of the Texas litigation. That had nothing to do with Michael whatsoever. It was completely wrong for the district court to have credited him with the full $620,000 debt. That was half of the judgment amount. And as I said, with respect, we agree with you
on the dragnet clause and find that it's not ambiguous. Do we have enough to calculate all of this in the record, or is this just something where we would reverse and remand for the district court to do so?
You know, first option I would say is I think that just based on the amounts of those, I think you have enough to reverse and reinstate the judgment. I think at that point, the onus is back on Michael. If he wants to make a new 60B5 motion asking for credit against the judgment, then I think that's the appropriate route. Alternatively, sure, you could send it back down for recalculation. But I think at this point, I think there was so much credit given just on the two properties that we've identified, the four, track 6 through 8 and track 5, that you could reinstate the entire $1.2 million judgment and let everybody just start over at that point. If he's got a basis, if he wants to come back in and contend that he's entitled to credit on that judgment, he can do that. And we'll go back at it. But right now, what we're asking for is that you reinstate that $1.2 million judgment. There was no ambiguity. And if you apply the security agreement as written, which is what the district court failed to do in this case, then there's absolutely no way he satisfied any portion of that judgment whatsoever. Unless the court has more questions for us, that's our position in a nutshell. I'll be happy to reserve my remaining time for the rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Mr. Shaw.
Alan Son on behalf of the Michael Evenson defendants. Counsel has completely ignored the merger doctrine, which is fully stated in our brief. And was fully stated in the briefs below. The merger doctrine bars the recovery of anything more than the judgment and the interest. That's well-settled law here in Illinois. It's well-settled law in Texas.
I would like to start with the same place I started with Mr. Vincent. Of the money that's disputed between the parties, is all of it or some part of it properly treated as future advances? That is, advances from the trust to Michael or one of his creditors after the date of the settlement agreement.
There were advances made, but not advances to Michael. There were monies that were...
Take Mr. Vincent's example of an advance made to pay off one of the liens against the property.
Right.
So that the trust had a higher priority when that property was sold. Does that count as a future advance?
That was a future advance.
Okay.
Not directly to Michael, but in order to increase the priority of the,
exactly,
of the plaintiff.
All right.
However,
so, Mr. Vincent, when I pressed him, said that all of the disputes here concern future advances. Is that true, or do you take a different position?
That's not true.
Okay. So tell me which of the advances, in your view, are not future advances for the purpose of this clause.
In the briefs below, in the argument below by the plaintiff, they did apply monies that they collected from the proceeds of properties to a prior debt of the debt that was not included in the settlement agreement, not included in the DOTSA, in the deed of trust. Also,
can you be precise? Right, we're going to have to go, when we go back, we're going to have to go and look at the record. I want you to tell me precisely which debt that is and which recovery that is, so we can look to see who's right. Because Mr. Vincent is saying all, and you're saying less than all. So which in particular?
I'd like to just answer part of your question that you answered. The money that was advanced by the trust to increase their priority was credited, they got that back. So we received less than the $500,000 or so of funds that the trust advanced. It was deducted from the money that they had collected. So as far as a prior, there was a single loan.
I'm asking you a concrete question to identify money that the trust credited against prior debts that preceded the settlement agreement.
I have to look at the brief, but there was a prior debt which they deducted, which they said that they were entitled to deduct from proceeds that they had collected. It would
right,
take,
but you can't identify it for me.
I can't identify it at this moment.
Okay. All right.
So now there are other arguments raised by the appellants in their reply brief, which had never been made before, either in their initial brief or in the briefs in the trial court below. They alleged that they were allowed to, as a judgment creditor under the UCC, to deduct attorney's fees from the sum of money that Michael was entitled to to satisfy the judgment. But they were citing cases under the UCC which do not apply here. There was only real estate that was being liened, that was subject to the liens, and there was no personal property. And in paragraph 23 of the deed of trust and security agreement, it states that unless to further secure indebtedness, grantors hereby grant to beneficiary security interest in and to the premises insofar as such premises consist of equipment, inventory, fixture, chattel paper, documents, and so on. There was no such property. All of this property was real property. Also, the clause in the UCC does not apply here because this was a case involving a deed of trust and security agreement that had no personal property. They also seek to recover for breach of contract. Now they say they can go after Michael Evenson defendants for breach of contract, but they elected the remedy under the settlement agreement to enter a judgment. The judgment under the law has a certain way of being executed. It didn't have, they wrote the judgment. It didn't have any provisions for attorney's fees, for costs. The one paragraph in the deed of trust, which refers to expenses of collection, which for the first time raised in their reply brief, refers only to expenses of collection incurred in recovering rents and other monies due from tenants. And so the expenses of collection that they seek to recover do not include attorney's fees.
Mr. Sohn, I'm yes. not following you. Whose law are you applying here?
I'm applying the law of Illinois and I'm applying the clear wording of the document. The document says expenses of collection. It doesn't say attorney's fees. They would like it to be expanded to attorney's fees.
So is there some Illinois case you want us to look at that expenses of collection can't include attorney's fees? The judgment's a federal document. So yes. Rule of Civil Procedure 69 throws us to Illinois law. So I would like to have a firm reference in Illinois law that you want us to look to.
The reference to Illinois law is that unless attorney's fees are specifically provided for by contract.
Cite something. Tell me what to look at.
What I have cited in my brief are the law of Illinois and the law that's universally recognized that attorney's
universally
fees.
Universally recognized.
In
I don't
just
want
about
to look at the
state.
Entire universe of cases. I want to look at particular cases. Do you have any?
I've cited cases in the brief that under the American rule, which I'll refer to you in my brief. FedDev International Limited versus Continental Insurance Company, 624 Federal 3rd, 834.
I hate to tell you, but that's not Illinois law.
It's a Seventh Circuit.
I'm asking you to cite Illinois law. The Seventh Circuit writes federal law. What Illinois case should I look at? You see why I'm frustrated. I hope you see why I'm frustrated.
Well, I can cite also Texas law under which
Texas law is not picked up by Rule 69.
But this
Rule 69 says that the right law to apply is the law of the state in which the federal court sits. That's Illinois. I'm looking for Illinois case law about what should be credited.
So I'm sorry, Judge. The facts of the FedNav case, I'm not sure if it was Illinois law or not, but there is a Texas case, and this is a Texas
law
agreement.
Is irrelevant. So your answer to my question is you don't know any Illinois case I should look at.
I don't have that right here, and I'm sorry about that. I apologize.
Okay.
Insofar as the district court's ruling regarding not allowing other debts or obligations other than the judgment, the settlement agreement was mentioned 17 times in the deed of trust. The indebtedness is defined as in the deed of trust and settlement agreement failed to mention or include any other debt or obligation of defendants as being included in the indebtedness, except if defendants or any of them were the principal, surety, endorser, accommodation party, or otherwise, and as a member of any partnership, syndicate, association, or other group.
Thank you, Mr. Sohn.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Very briefly, Judge. I did want to try and get more granular with you about the tracks and the values. Track one, there was a $75,000 credit given. That's really not an issue. Track two, involving the Sadoff property, there was a rather complicated history with regard to that property, but basically monies that were recovered from the foreclosure in that instance were applied to a promissory note guarantee that we contend survived the settlement agreement, which Michael breached and cannot avail himself of its terms for release anymore. With respect to the track five, we talked about that, the senior lien, the taxes, rents, all future advances, all properly added to Michael's debt. With respect to tracks six through eight, there we're talking about the $620,000 recovery of the settlement. In that context, that is a collection expense under paragraph six, which would qualify as a future advance under that context. So that's the breakdown of what we're looking at. And that's why we contend the judgment should be reinstated.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent. The case is taken under advisement.